from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Public swim is Monday through Friday from 6 to 9 p.m. and Saturday from noon to 5 p.m. The pool is closed on Sunday. There will be special hours when Urbana School District is not in session or when there are swim meets. All hours of operation are contingent on staffing levels. For more information, please call Urbana Indoor Aquatic Center at 217-384-7665. And now stay tuned for today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for a pre-recorded interview with author and sibling Gina Rowland. But first, disability news for the week of February 20th, 2023. According to advocate, parent, and journalist Ed McMahon, the state of Illinois is finally taking a step to potentially change business as usual in the 7-state-operated developmental centers. DHS has begun the process of hiring a consultant to assist with a plan to improve services at state institutions. The request is asking for a plan for what is called right-sizing SODCs, but they did not define the terminology. The request for proposals was issued quietly, and it is not known why the department chose to keep it a secret. The RFP says the department is, quote, establishing a comprehensive evaluation improvement initiative to optimize the delivery of services at the 7 SODCs. The title of the project is Expert Consultation and Technical Assistance on the Management of the SODCs. It also says that DHS is seeking consultants with expertise in current issues and trends, planning and strategies, and problem resolution in publicly funded and run facilities that serve individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Recommendations will be sought in the areas of appropriate staffing, best models for serving people with high support needs, and ways to enhance the resources provided for the operation of the SODCs, including assessment and evaluation of staffing. Despite the use of the word resizing, there's no indication that the state plans to downsize or develop more community-based settings for their residents. Recent reports of violence against residents at Choate Developmental Center in downstate Anna have prompted calls to either reform it or shut it down. Illinois currently houses 1,650 persons in state-run institutions, and only the state of Texas has more. A bipartisan bill introduced this month in the U.S. Senate would require the Department of Transportation to publish an annual report disclosing the number of complaints the agency has received in the previous 5 years regarding passengers with disabilities, as well as the type of complaints received. Other requirements would be a report to detail the review process for prior complaints and how quickly each was reviewed and resolved. Currently, the Transportation Department is not required to report data on disability complaints it receives related to air travel, but a Government Accountability Office report last year showed that problems are increasing rapidly, with almost 1,400 complaints in 2021, which was 157% higher than in 2020 and 54% higher than in 2019. The senators behind the new bill say that travelers with disabilities routinely encounter issues ranging from untrained staff to damaged or lost wheelchairs and even physical injuries. Said Tammy Duckworth, senator from Illinois, one of the bill's sponsors, quote, "For too long, carriers have gotten away with predatory practices that view passengers with disabilities as disposable. By preventing disability-related complaints from being swept under the rug, our bipartisan bill would shine a light on these problems and help ensure that the millions of passengers with disabilities who fly every year are treated with the dignity and respect they deserve, end quote. Duckworth introduced the bill known as the Prioritizing Accountability and Accessibility for Aviation Consumers Act of 2023 with Senator Deb Fisher of Nebraska. And finally, Denver City Councilman Chris Hines couldn't get his wheelchair onto the stage for the debate for his council seat. And according to him, if he couldn't participate, he'd be forced to return about $125,000 in campaign financing from the city's Fair Elections Fund. Hines said, quote, "It was a choice between my campaign's viability or my dignity," end quote. So Hines had to climb out of his wheelchair and crawl onto the stage in front of the debate crowd of several dozen people, delaying the event during the process. When the event organizers were unable to lift Hines's electric wheelchair onto the platform, the group held the debate on the floor in front of the stage. The event, facilitated by the Denver Clerk and Recorder's Office, was held at a local dance school. Hines said, in addition to being humiliating, the lack of access was alarming. The Americans with Disabilities Act, which requires governments to provide equal access to public facilities for people with disabilities, is more than 30 years old. Hines said, quote, "It's kind of hard, really, to say that this is excusable at this point. I really hope that this is a teachable moment of why it's important to have a government that's representative of all the people and why it's important to have disability representation on the council," end quote. A spokesperson for the dance school said the venue didn't receive requests for additional or enhanced accommodations ahead of the event. According to Mike Oxford, interim director for Atlantis Community Incorporated, an accessibility nonprofit in Denver, the event must comply with state and federal accessibility standards regardless of whether someone asks. Hines, a prominent advocate for accessibility in Denver, noted that the fact that he uses a wheelchair is commonly known throughout the city. Denver Clerk Paul Lopez said in a statement that he regrets that Hines had an adverse experience at the debate and apologized personally to him. And that's the news for this week. And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander. I'm happy to be joined today on the phone by Gina Rowland, who is an author and also the sister of a woman with a disability. Welcome to the program, Gina.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners a little bit, and then we'll dig into the details of all the stuff that you came to talk about.
Well, I'm Gina Rowland, and I wrote a book called For the Love about my sister from earliest memory to about 25 years old, and just our journey together. And that is kind of thrown a net around the world to connect me to all different families from all over the world and their stories.
Yeah, and there are an abundance of interesting stories out there. Would it make sense to start with a little bit of information about your sister, your relationship with your sister, and how that has evolved over the years?
Well, Serena was born a year before me, so she's my older sister.
Mm-hmm.
And she was born in 67. A lot of changes from the 60s, 70s, 80s to now. We did a journey out west when we were in our 20s and had a lot of ableism thrown at us when we didn't know what the word was or mm-hmm. have verbiage to express that. But we pushed through, and she trailblazed a lot in working in the community and working a regular full-time job in the 90s. And she has progressed to having her own business at this point and being an artist. And she has had many different living situations, from, you know, living with me to her own apartment to a group home setting to back in her own apartment to having an apartment in my home. So she has had the gamut of living situations and experiences there.
And so I'm assuming that your parents at some point passed away, and you felt as, or maybe it was planned from the beginning, that your sister would be cared for by you. Is that essentially what happened there?
Well, no, my parents are both alive when my sister. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she just wanted the same experiences as any other 20-year-old. And my parents being older when she was born, really couldn't offer her that. They were afraid. They wanted her to stay with them, and she wanted to experience life. So I took her out west, and she certainly did that and excelled. And my mom just passed away in 2020.
Sorry to hear that. But, what a wonderful opportunity for your sister to be taken under your wing, to be able to live life like any other person. Because I know, and we had this conversation on the phone earlier today, that oftentimes parents aren't even aware of the limits that they put on their children. And so, and communities and, you know, businesses and all those places struggle with, or people with disabilities struggle with, the concept of ableism being thrown at them. And we've talked a little bit about that, but I think it might be good to maybe put some definition to that word. When you say ableism, what do you mean by that?
Well, I'll give you a little background first on how ableism emerged. I mean, the concept of ableism emerged in the 60s and 70s when a disability activist placed disability in a political context. And the phrase was coined in a London press release in the 80s. Mm. And it truly wasn't mainstreamed until recently. And it's discriminating in favor of able-bodied people. So it makes the world very unwelcoming, very inaccessible to people with disabilities. Before the laws, like the Rehabilitation Act, the Individuals with Disability Education Act, and the Americans with Disability Act, it was very legal to exclude people with disabilities from government services, from employment, public schools, to enter businesses, to buy things, to have any services. And even after these laws were put in place, they were still discriminated, and we still have to fight to this day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So examples of, you know, of that are, you know, I have been a service coordinator working with people with disabilities for years, and recently retired. And just a few years ago, we were still fighting in schools for access to ramps into schools and high schools in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
New Hampshire was the first state in the nation to deinstitutionalize. So we're very proud of that. But in talking with you today, I realized that there are still institutions that are running for children and adults.
Yeah, a bunch of them here in Illinois. And there is a battle, ongoing battle, by advocates here to close those. And they've gotten a couple of them closed, but not all.
Yeah, it'd be very good to have a plan to put in place when that happens, so you can have different living situations. Because, you know, here they just kind of closed them down and didn't know what to do. It was up to the parents. The parents closed it down, the parents did the lawsuit, and the parents created what they thought were safe environments. But that was even ableist, because it segregated them from the rest of society. They had a workshop and a farm and group homes, and they were, even though they were in a city, they were still separate.
Yeah, and that is very, very common. I know that if the institutions in Illinois closed down tomorrow, there would be a real scramble because there's just not enough money put into services that people can get in their own home in the community.
Yes.
So,
and that's why, you know, in New Hampshire, we have to go to the State House every 2 years and testify before the Finance Committee. Because they always threaten to take the funding away.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of funding system do they have in New Hampshire right now? Or you haven't been there, or are you there now?
I am in New Hampshire now.
Yeah, so what kind of funding does your sister have there?
Well, they have different levels of funding. She has what's called a PDMS plan, mm-hmm. And that's, she lives with family, and I control her budget, and I hire staff if I want to take her to do whatever we're working on with her. And then she has a residential budget. So that works. They also have an enhanced family plan model, mm-hmm. where an individual or two individuals with a disability live with a family or a couple or a single person, depending on, you know, who they want to live with and what jives with that person. And then they also, unfortunately, have group homes still. But we don't have a lot of group homes in New Hampshire.
That's good. We do in Illinois up to, you know, most of them have 6 or 8 people in them, which is not exactly a typical living situation. So that can be a problem as well. What kinds of things, when you took your sister under your wing years ago, what were some of the things that you experienced that brought you to a point where you said, yes, this is ableism, and, you know, this is what it means for us?
Well, in work, Serena wanted to work, and she was a very good worker, and we found her a job, and she interviewed for it and did very well, and it was working in a macadamia nut factory, just separating good nuts from bad nuts, and it was a very simple job for her to do, and she worked full-time. It was Monday through Friday, 8 hours a day. Mm. And I was called into work quite often because her fellow co-workers did not want to work with her. They felt it was beneath them that she shouldn't be there working, and she wasn't invited on breaks. She had to eat lunch alone. It was very difficult, for her and for me, because in being a family member, and I was only in my 20s at the time, I thought everyone would accept her like I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a rude awakening for me to experience that. We came from a very small town where everybody knew her, everybody loved her, and then to go to Las Vegas where nobody knew her, nobody loved her, it was quite a challenge. But she rose to that, and I went to her work frequently and tried to educate.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't go very well because it was still the 90s, but she stayed there and she worked. Unfortunately, we got a call from Social Security saying that if she worked anymore, they would take her Social Security away because she wasn't deemed disabled anymore because she could work.
Yeah, and that's a whole other kind of a concept that probably needs another 2 shows to deal with. But you're right. I mean, that is just stupid. But that's the way the system works. Where do you think, and I have my own opinion about where this comes from, but where do you think this, the idea of ableism, that people believing that people with disabilities aren't as good as they are if they don't have a disability, where does that come from?
I think it comes from just our own lens and society. Society has, you know, you never saw someone with a difference in a commercial. You never saw someone of difference out in nightclubs. You weren't educated about it. Even my own friends say they were just ignorant to being exposed to anyone that had a difference. And so they had their own ideas about it and about people. And that's where I think it comes from, because it's just, it's out of ignorance.
Yeah. And I think that starts pretty young, too. Wouldn't you say? I mean, what, I don't know what your sister's situation was when she was in school, but back in the day, it was very, very separate, that there was, you know, special education, and some kids even went to special schools.
Right. I actually went to college for special education, and they had an entire separate school for people with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't exist anymore. Serena was in a special class, but in my school.
So yeah.
I see her during the day, but we didn't have classes together. Looking back at it, she definitely could have been in some of the classes with an aide.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah.
Know, but then if they were in a different wing in the school, didn't have lunches with us. And by high school level, she was bussed out of town.
Yeah.
So middle school, she went with us, but high school, she was separated.
That is certainly not unusual.
No, no. And if you don't, you know, expose your children in the general population early, they don't have that relationship with someone with a different ability. My friends, when we were little growing up, Serena played with all of us, so they knew her growing up and didn't treat her any differently and accepted her wholeheartedly. But friends that I you know, met as adults had to get to learn and know Serena.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they love her more than me. That's the point. But it was a learning curve. They had a lot of questions about her, which I wasn't used to, because my friends growing up, they knew her like I knew her. But
so you're back in New Hampshire after, you know, living various places. And in recent years, how have you seen ableism rearing its ugly head? Has there been any incident in the last few years that comes to mind for you, or are things pretty calm right now and settled?
No, there's ableism everywhere, from professionals to people that you work with. I worked with a young gentleman named Andy, and he has Down syndrome, and he was in charge of the whole back room when one of the staff was called out or out sick. Andy would take over, and he was getting paid pennies on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And not minimum wage, and I thought that was completely against his rights, and so I advocated for him. And he ended up getting minimum wage, but it was a battle, and that was only a few years ago.
A lot of people don't understand this whole idea of the sub-minimum wage. I know that there's legislation out there to banish it, and it should be banished.
It's really criminal. It truly is, because they work just as hard as anyone else, and to get paid pennies on a dollar is insulting.
Yeah.
I would be insulted.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people are.
Yeah. And for Serena, I mean, she was a grocery bagger for a long time. I got called into work one day, and they said they were suspending her because she ran away from her job, from her station. Fortunately, she was union at the time, so when we had to go for a meeting for her suspension, the union came in, and the union actually talked to the other staff and said, well, her boss was yelling at her, and when the boss yelled at her, it scared her, and she took off. Well, that part was omitted from what I was told.
Mm.
So the union actually was on Serena's side, and her supervisor ended up getting suspended instead. So that was good. But if we didn't advocate and she didn't have union, she probably would have been suspended or fired for a behavior.
Yeah. And I think that that is an easy excuse that people can use, that business owners can use to not hire or ultimately, you know, lay off or fire somebody with a disability because they act differently they respond differently, maybe, than other people might.
Right.
But it's that lack of experience with people that have differences that makes such a huge impact on the world for people with disabilities.
Yeah. So, and just like, you know, going to the hospital, she was going in for a regular, you know, like a colonoscopy procedure.
Mm-hmm.
Nurse who was lovely was setting her up, and not realizing it that she was saying, you know, horrible things to me. But she, you know, she's like, "Does she have Down syndrome?" And I said, "Well, of course she has Down syndrome." And she goes, "Well, she didn't look it, so I didn't know." And I said, "Okay." And then she says, "Well, what's her functioning? How does she function?" And, you know, I was so offended, but I couldn't express that. I had to educate her in a very nice manner. And I said, you know, we don't use that term, you know, functioning.
Yeah.
Low functioning, high functioning. I said, she can understand you. She can read and write. You might want to talk to her about that. I always try to have people talk directly to Serena instead of me.
Yeah.
And that's a form of ableism as well, when they want to ask her a question and she's standing right next to me, but they ask me instead.
Yeah, and I don't want to ignore the fact that you've written a book about your relationship with your sister. You want to just take a minute to describe what that's about, maybe point people to where they might be able to buy a copy of it.
Oh, well, you can buy a copy of it on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And the book was really written as, it was springboarded from a story that I had written for Chicken Soup for the Soul, for special needs. And, you know, it's kind of funny because that term special needs now is not acceptable since 2015.
Yeah, because her needs aren't special. She has the same needs as everybody else, right?
Right. So, you know, different terms, and I want people to understand that too. It changes all the time. As we evolve, our language evolves. And what was acceptable back then, I mean, Serena was able to be called a mongoloid and downy and special needs and, you know, a special child and, you know, all this stuff. And just last year, there was a movement to change Down syndrome to Up syndrome because some families felt it had a negative connotation. And, you know, the only reason it's called Down syndrome because the doctor who discovered it, his last name was Down.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't find anything negative to it, but everyone has a different opinion.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us today for the interview. You can get For the Love, as Gina says, on Amazon. Gina Roland, author and sibling. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Vicki.
Bye-bye. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week.
No, I'll stand my ground. Won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground. And I won't back down.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, and coming up next is Food Sleuth Radio, so stay tuned for that and other great programming here on WEFT Community Radio. Without further ado, let's get to our next program.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hebelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today I'm honored to welcome my guest, Dr. Christopher Hobbs. He is a fourth generation international